As I said earlier, Mr. Dream, and as for those who came in late, he has not only expanded to South Korea now, but is China, and it looks like Japan may be on the horizon, and his books are translated in many languages. But the thing I really appreciate is that this is Jeremy's life. You know, he carries that book around with him. And if you tell a dream, it's probably in that book, you know. But everything that happens all the day long with him, he's got that. And he's working with dreams every day, about 360 days a year. And so he has immense knowledge. But I love that he sits down at the table and with anybody he's willing to discuss, he's there for you. And we appreciate that, Jeremy, very much. So we now are going to evolve. So, come forward for dreams and the evolution of consciousness. You need to match the clock. There's your 50 minutes, Jeremy.
Counting down. 50 minutes and counting.
That's 49.
That's right. Okay. Thank you. Once again, I need to begin with even more formal gratitude than that. Clearly, I am not the only one who lives this life. And I think we all owe Bob a tremendous debt of gratitude for the energy that he has put. Not only into this conference, but into the Institute and the brilliant training programs that he has devised. A lot of what I'm going to say today is counterintuitive from the perspective of waking life. And I want to remind everybody initially that even when dreams have literal meanings, they also have symbolic and metaphoric meanings. Even if my dream is grabbing me by my sleeve and saying, "Listen, Jeremy, your brakes are shot. Take your car into the mechanic," there will always be a level of that dream that talks about metaphoric brakes and the difficulty I am having setting boundaries. Mistaken literalism is the greatest stumbling block in this work. And one of the things that separates sophisticated dream workers from beginning dream workers, no matter how long they've been at it, is this tendency that we all have to take the emotions in the dream literally. Even people who understand that the fundamental nature of the dream is metaphoric tend to take the emotional narrative as a given. Let me give you an example, because again, I think examples work a whole lot better than theory. Just looking at the self-selection process that brought us all to this conference, you can see that at this stage of history, this work appeals to women more than men. And 40 years ago, I would have been the only man in the room. For decades, I was the only man in the room. And I want to thank and salute my brothers who have come here. Indeed. And I want to say something about us. It's presumptuous to speak for my brothers, but from my experience, for what it's worth, we are all here because we have been bludgeoned and disappointed into being here. That we were all the apparent beneficiaries of institutional sexism. Apparently our lives were better because we were given this bogus edge on things. But in fact, our lives were not better. And to come here as a man is to recognize that the story that we were told as little boys was a lie. And that's hard. That's a hard place to come from. And I salute my brothers for recognizing that in some fashion or another. Given that I have worked with many fewer dreams of men than I have of women, there is still a pattern that is worth mentioning that is a dramatic example of this point that I'm trying to make about taking the emotions in the dream literally. By far, the majority of dreams that I have worked with men have been characterized by anger. In the dream world, men tend to be angry. And yes, there are literal levels of that anger. Most of us have all kinds of legitimate stuff to be angry about. But what I have discovered over the years is that one of the ways institutional sexism affects men is that as we are growing up, we are informed at all levels, conscious and unconscious, by the society we're growing up in, that anger is the only strong emotion that they will accept from us. So we begin to experience consciously a whole range of emotions as anger. We experience grief as anger all the time. We experience fear as anger. We experience attraction as anger. We experience revulsion as anger. We experience a range of emotions consciously in the waking world as though it were anger. And so to take anger in a dream literally is to limit yourself only to those things that you probably already know about why you're angry. And to see the anger in a dream as a marker of other deep feelings which have not had any kind of habitual opportunity to be appropriately named is a much more sophisticated and ultimately useful and valuable way to work with the emotions in the dream. Now, that's just one fairly obvious example. My experience is that all the emotions in the dream, even when they are literal, also have these other, even more important layers of meaning. And that to get to the main thread of what I want to say this morning, consciousness evolves as we begin to call things by their right names. If we were not still groaning under the weight of Roman imperialism, as I believe that we are, one example being that we are still using imperial Roman models as our benchmarks for opulence and success, if we were not still groaning under the weight of Roman imperialism, I suspect we would have abandoned the term unconscious as our primary technical term a long time ago. Because as near as I can make out, the only thing it has going for it is that it has been cobbled together from academically fashionable Latin roots. It doesn't really tell us much. I mean, how in fact can something be un and conscious all at the same time? There is a phrase, however, out of the Anglo-Saxon word hoard that serves our purposes a great deal better. It's the phrase used by the Gawain poet and the Pearl poet to describe not only the source of dreams, but the source of poetry. And that phrase is not yet speech ripe, as in fruit. And if when you read the word unconscious or hear the word unconscious, you try experimentally translating in your mind with the phrase not yet speech ripe, I think you will have a much clearer understanding of what's actually going on. As Carl Jung said over and over again over the course of his entire life, the problem with the unconscious is it really is unconscious. We really do not know. In that sense, it is like the archetypal metaphor of air as spirit. One of the reasons that metaphor appears universally is that our human experience of the wind, regardless of language, regardless of culture, regardless of gender, regardless of age, regardless of passionately held convictions or not, is that we can't see it. All we can see are the consequences of its motion. And one of the ancillary symbolic consequences of that is that when smoke appears in the dream world, you can be very sure that at some important level, it is an effort to make the unseen spiritual word visible. It is also true in religious rituals. When the censer is being waved, when smoke fills the air in a religious ritual, you can be very sure that one of the main points of that moment in the ritual is to make the presence of the spirit tangible and visible to the gathered, whoever they may be. Now, this is true in Christianity, and it is also true across the board in all the world's religions. Now, I understand that I am speaking to a passionate Christian crowd here. And I need to confess to you that I am not a Christian. I have immense respect for Christianity, but my interest is broader than that. At least that's how I see it. Christianity stands among the religions of the world in giving passionate, meaningful shape to the archetype of willing sacrifice. It does not stand above the other traditions of the world in giving shape to this crucially important archetype. And at this point in my life, it is the archetype of willing sacrifice that I am most interested in. Because we were having an interesting conversation about this at breakfast. My experience is that it is the archetypal drama that characterizes the authentic evolution of consciousness. There are many reasons to evolve our consciousness. Increased pleasure is seldom one of them. I was reading a very poignant unpublished letter of Carl Jung's the other day in an article that he wrote to this enthusiastic American woman who wrote him this long letter about how his work had opened her eyes and she was going to come to Zurich and work with him and this was the way and the light. And Jung wrote her back this letter and said, well, you know, I'm really pleased that my work has touched you in this fashion, but you must understand that if you embark on this path, you're going to be miserable. And why would you want to do that? Well, it's an interesting question, and the answer uniformly in my experience is that comfort and convenience are willingly sacrificed for something of even greater value. And that whatever plateau of development we have reached, particularly in our spiritual lives, it is that very achievement which must ultimately be sacrificed in order to strive for the next deeper layer of communion with the divine. Now, I have to put a quick footnote in here about my hesitance in using the G word. I am a Unitarian Universalist minister, and one of the things that means is that, well, I should say right from the get-go, I am an itinerant preacher. I don't have a congregation to keep me honest. And one of the things that means is that you shouldn't take my word for anything. Us itinerant preachers are a notoriously untrustworthy breed, and you shouldn't take our word for anything, let alone anything as important as what the deeper meanings of your dreams might be. So I want to make it very clear right from the beginning that I am specifically asking you not to take my word for any of this stuff. Essentially, what I'm trying to do here today is to present you with a set of ideas for you to run up against your own experience to see whether or not your experience is illuminated by any of these notions. My experience has been so consistently illuminated by these notions that the only thing that would surprise me would be if they were not of use to you. But that is the important point. It's a little bit, and I expect everyone in this room has suffered from this, it's a little bit like forcing kids to read Shakespeare before they're ready. How many of us hated Shakespeare when we were forced at gunpoint to read it? And it's a tremendous shame because he is a treasure of our world culture. And to have that treasure polluted by having to take somebody's word that this is great literature and it's what we ought to be reading ruins it. And my experience is that spiritual truth in its initial encounter is even more fragile than great literature. We have to come to these experiences voluntarily out of the rhythm of our own lives. And the rhythm of our own lives, although it shows large patterns, is going to be specifically different in each individual case. Essentially, the ultimate reason for evolving our consciousness is to participate in an increasingly self-aware fashion with the evolving relationship with that which cannot be spoken. that which is not some secret that the initiates are keeping to themselves out of meanness, but that which is literally beyond our ability to frame in words or images or even half-speakable intuitive understandings. When I use the G word, I use it as a placeholder for and if we can understand that that's how I use it, then I will be much more comfortable about using it when I speak. The other piece of all of that is that on any given Sunday in any Unitarian Universalist congregation in North America, it is exceedingly likely that somewhere near half the people in the pews are refugees from spiritual abuse in other traditions. Unitarian Church is a sort of triage center for spiritual abuse. And much of that abuse has been delivered by God language. So in order not to distress the newly arrived, most of my colleagues invent elaborate circumlocutions to avoid using the word God. And we get used to it. It gets to be a habit. For me, the easiest circumlocution is the divine. And since it's a spoken, you can't even tell whether it's a capital D or not. I tend to use the divine as a placeholder for all of that. And unlike a lot of my colleagues, I know that that language is a desperate attempt to communicate about non-material realities that are in fact real. And probably the greatest question inside my denomination and the liberal religious denominations in general is this longing for communion with the divine simply a leftover from emotional and spiritual childhood? Is it simply nostalgia and therefore to be eschewed by responsible adults? Or is it in fact part of a legitimate, mature adult relationship with the truth? Now, I believe all my experience convinces me that it is a fundamental part of a legitimate, mature adult relationship with the truth. I stand in something of a minority in my own denomination by believing that. But one of the nice things about my denomination is that the principle of freedom of conscience is the rock that stands at the center of that foundation. So I am allowed to think that. As came up in a conversation over a meal a couple of days ago, although I am a Unitarian by theological history, I am also a convinced Trinitarian. I believe that our experience of the divine, just as our experience of everything else in our lives, again, regardless of language, regardless of gender, regardless of historical circumstances, regardless even of our relative states of mental and emotional stability, comes naturally in three parts, past, present, and future. And that these trinities that pop out of all the world religions, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost being the most familiar one, Maiden, Matron, and Crone being one that is experiencing a revival, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, the great trinity of Hinduism, the three gems of bodhicitta in Buddhism, that these trinities all pop up in an effort to symbolically acknowledge that our experience of the divine comes naturally in three parts, in the same way that our experience of everything else comes in three parts. Our memory of the past, our experience of the present, and our anticipation of the future. I also believe that that famous biblical line that's translated in James, in the King James Version anyway, as the fullness of time is a reference to the experience of the divine requiring all three of those persons, if you will, to be simultaneously present. I used to think it meant later. I used to think the fullness of time meant a long time from now. But what I now understand that to mean at a much more important level is when the anticipation of the future, the experience of the present, and the memory of the past all merge into a single experience of the divine. That is the fullness of time. And that is the kingdom that is laid out before us. That is the kingdom that is present with us here. Individual consciousness has to evolve to put itself in a position to have that kind of experience. And this evolution is a tricky business because it requires us to face the darkness in a fashion that we are intuitively unprepared to do. There is this archetypal resonance all over the planet between the direction up and light and consciousness and the good, which exists in a paired fashion with the direction down and darkness and unconsciousness and evil. And part of what we are required to do, I believe, as human beings, is to disconnect this natural intuitive understanding of light and dark and up and down and good and evil, and recognize that everything which is shining and beautiful in the waking world is not good. There's all sorts of evil that comes dressed up in pretty lights, and that everything that is dark and immediately nerve-wracking and even repulsive is not evil. That in fact, to the extent that darkness is an archetypal metaphor of unconsciousness, which it clearly is in our dreams and in our sacred narratives all over the world, then that darkness not only hides all our potentials for evil action that we have not yet undertaken, it also hides all our possibilities for evolved consciousness and increased awareness of the divine. So that if we reject the darkness in ourselves and in others and turn our backs on it with elaborate spiritual practices that focus only on the light, one of the ironic consequences of that inevitably is a freezing of our relationship to the divine in an incomplete fashion. It is another one of the reasons why I am a Unitarian Universalist. I do not believe that anything worthy of the noble name God can be delimited by mere human language forms. That to imagine that any human language is capable of saying what God is and what God isn't is hubris of the highest degree. And we all know what the punishment for hubris is. The punishment for hubris is a nasty encounter with the trickster. Whenever we are enticed into the position of believing that everything important is known and that the only thing that's left are refinements in administration, that is a recipe for the awakening of the trickster. And the trickster will yawn and stretch and look around and knock over whatever sandcastles we have built. It is one of the reasons that I have devoted my life to dream work for the last 40 years. It's an uncomfortable realization. I began in my early 20s. I'm now in my early 60s. The math is inescapable. One of the reasons I do this is that all dreams in my experience come in the service of health and wholeness. Even the worst, gut-wrenching, sweat-popping nightmares. At the same time, I also know that the dreams do not come in the service of comfort and convenience. I mean, it sounds so nice to say all dreams come in the service of health and wholeness. Everything must be peachy then. But it isn't. Because when the dreams are offered a choice between health and wholeness and comfort and convenience, they will take health and wholeness every time, regardless of the grotesque inconvenience and discomfort that that realization may engender. So this business of evolving consciousness in order to actually deepen our relationship with the divine isn't a sort of 19th century graph of progress where it's just onward and upward into the light. And I'm always a little anxious and sad about saying this. My experience, for what it's worth, is if that is the archetypal model of one's spirituality, one will end up with a sense of profound separation from the divine. As my friend Bill Sherman says, presence of God not felt. And it is tragic because that desire is a natural desire. But the evolution of consciousness requires us to willingly sacrifice that less sophisticated understanding of our relationship to the divine through our evolving experience. And if we attempt to predetermine where our evolving experience is going to take us, there is a tendency in the dream world to have nasty dreams about sex. Because as has already been mentioned here, we human beings are inherently predisposed in the dream world to use sexual and sensual longing and experience as an archetypal symbol for all other orders of higher longing. There are, in essence, two kinds of sex in the dream world. There's the kind that Freud spent his life looking at. It turns out he's right. Everything in the dream world is sexy. Going through a door is sexy. Not going through a door is sexy. Running a sewing machine is so sexy we shouldn't even talk about it. And it is, in fact, true that our dreams adopt this pattern of symbolism universally. I don't necessarily think it is always the most important thing that's going on, but I do know that it's always there. Freud is right, at least to that extent. And then there are those dreams where the sexuality and sensuality is not in symbolic form. It is right there, bodies, orgasms or the lack of them. It's all just right there without any symbolic covering at all. And one of the unexamined legacies of Freud amongst our dream work colleagues is to say, well, all dreams are about sex, and those dreams are really about sex. And there will be levels of truth to that. You can limit your work with the overtly sexual and sensual dreams to sexual sensual issues in the dreamer's life, and you will produce important levels of meaning. The problem is that you will miss other, from my point of view, even more important levels of meaning. When the dream experience involves nasty, coercive sex that feels more like rape than like lovemaking, it is so universally true that it is always worth asking the question, is this yet again a metaphor of attempting to determine by conscious will what the nature of my spiritual experience is going to be like? And the opinion of the dream source, the opinion of what Carl Jung calls the collective unconscious, appears to be that to attempt to manipulate our spontaneous spiritual experience, to force it to conform to predetermined categories, is analogous to rape. Yes, indeed, communion with the divine can take place under those circumstances in the same way that actual sexual union takes place during rape. But the dream asks the question, is that the point? Is it simply about having a coercive relationship with the divine, or is it more like seeking for the longed-for loved one and finding him or her and then entering into a natural and joyful expression of the recognition of this relationship? When we enter seriously and wholeheartedly into this effort to increase our conscious understanding of and our conscious awareness of the divine, we volunteer, whether we were consciously aware of it or not, to be the carriers of what, from an immediate perspective, are extremely nasty experiences. Because in this archetype that Carl Jung calls the shadow lie all the potentials of the unconscious. The shadow always holds as a hostage of its seemingly irredeemably nasty appearance the very thing that we need, the very thing without which we cannot take the next genuine step toward true health and wholeness rather than some model that we have in our minds of what it's going to look like. And the worse the shadow appears to be, the more valuable the gift is that it holds in hiding for us. That means that spiritual practices which insulate us from the dark, insulate us from the horrible, ultimately have the ironic effect of limiting the possibilities of our evolving spiritual awareness, which is linked fundamentally to our consciousness. And the ultimate reason for evolving consciousness is, to use traditional language, to serve the Lord. That the universe itself appears to be interested in this experiment of self-awareness that we human beings represent. Jung himself came to the theological belief that God's creation is only completed with the evolution of human consciousness, that human beings co-create the world with God, and that that is an unfinished process, and the way that process moves in the direction of completion is for human consciousness to evolve. And those of us who turn our attention to the dream, knowing that it is a source of information that is much more valuable than the sources that consciousness has access to from other consciousnesses, that puts us in the position of encountering these new possibilities in ways that frighten us. Death, certainly in the dream world, and I am increasingly suspicious in the waking world as well, is the single most frequent and reliable archetypal symbol of the evolution of consciousness that has to offer. If I have a dream in which death appears as part of the manifest content of the dream, it is so often true that it's always worth asking if it might be the case again. Am I engaged in a process of psycho-spiritual growth and change that is so deep that only the death of who I used to be, or some aspect of who I used to think I was, is an adequate symbol for the profundity of the process that I am engaged in? And given the nature of willing sacrifice, it is often the death of what I was most proud of, the death of the thing I worked hardest to achieve. Now, there's lots of examples of this. The one that makes the most sense to me, that I hope will make the most sense to you, is parenting. There are a lot of parents here in this room, and I believe you all know that when our kids are little, in order to be a good parent, if I don't do this, I am not a good parent, we must protect our children from intrusive and unwanted sexual information. If we do not protect our children from that information, we are not being good parents. But the time arrives when, to go on being a good parent, we have to reverse field. We have to introduce our kids to sexual information in a way that does not distress and traumatize them the way it will if they just pick up the news on the street. So the very thing which made us good parents a week ago makes us bad parents if we are not willing to sacrifice it. And the more my sense of worth resides in being a good parent, and the longer this sense of being a good parent has been reinforced by this protective role that I am playing, the harder the willing sacrifice of giving that up will be. And I don't know any parent who gets it right. We always run off habit. We always miss that moment, and somebody will let us know. Sometimes it's our kids themselves who will let us know. And at that point, we have to willingly give up the very thing that it would have been wrong not to develop to begin with. It's not like it was a mistake to be that kind of parent. It was absolutely what was required at that time. But what was absolutely required at that time becomes a mistake as the situation evolves. If the situation evolves and our consciousness does not parallel that evolution, then we are in the ironic position of turning into monster parents with the very energies that actually seriously made us good parents a moment ago. Now, I offer that example because I think it resonates probably with everyone's experience in this room, either as a parent or as a child who had a parent, or a parent substitute. And it is, I wish to emphasize, it's only an example of what I am talking about the nature of willing sacrifice. I hope it's an obvious enough example that you can get a feel for it. The problem in my experience is that it also relates to our evolving theological conscious understanding of our relationship with the divine. If that relationship becomes frozen and our sense of worth is invested in having cultivated that relationship in that fashion, then we are inevitably going to be in the position of the parent who is unable and unwilling to grow and to parent in a more conscious and supportive fashion. And our relationship with the divine will crumble. And if we are honest, we will notice it crumbling. And if we aren't honest, we will turn our spiritual practices into addiction. Seems to me the only definition of addiction that makes any sense is that it is any activity the purpose of which, consciously or unconsciously, is to numb me and isolate me from the full impact of my authentic experience. So if I am a particularly religious person with psycho-spiritual work yet to do, which if I'm being honest with myself has to be the case, and I run into one of those moments where some unexpected, imponderable, seemingly shadowy and dark and nasty piece of myself bubbles to the surface, anything I do to avoid that confrontation becomes an addiction. And in the world that I live in, teaching in seminaries and theological sabbatical programs, I know many, many more people who are addicted to prayer and good work than who are addicted to sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Because whenever something problematic arises out of their own interior being, they look around for somebody to help. And as a community organizer, my tragic experience is if we engage in work in the world, which is ultimately and secretly, because it is unconscious, an expression of addictive behavior, then our efforts in the world will become examples of the law of unintended consequences, and the very things that we are trying to do will ironically rebound and create even worse situations than the ones we were trying to do something about. So I come at this not only from a spiritual seeker's point of view, but from a community organizer's point of view, because in the world that I travel in, I know way more folks who are addicted to social action and the efforts to change the world than are addicted to alcohol or tobacco or sex or any of that other stuff. The moment something problematic arises, they rush out with a petition. They throw themselves in front of the train filled with ammunition headed for Iraq. They engage in dramatic, heroic behavior, which on the surface of it is absolutely laudable and brave. But the dreams will make it clear that in addition to the conscious motivations which they are aware of and celebrating, there are these unconscious motivations, and those are for the purpose of avoiding the impact of evolving psycho-spiritual experience. It's a tough one. I always feel a certain amount of hesitation to say all of this, but I figure you didn't bring me here to not tell you what I think. And since you've invited me back, I figure that it is my obligation to say this. Now, that's all background. And in the last 10 minutes, I want to address this question of how do I know where the growing edges of my consciousness are? And I want to talk about that particularly in terms of the memorability of dream experience. What we are able to remember from our dreams and what we are not able to remember is a definition, a symbolic definition of the growing edge of our evolving consciousness. Now, I suspect everyone here in this room has already embarked on that process, and I suspect that one of the pieces of evidence for that is that my guess is that everyone here in this room has remembered at least a handful of dreams in which you were in two places at once. There's the dream going on, happening, going on the way it always is, and I'm in my dream body, seemingly embodied the way I am in the physical world, looking out my dream eyes, running around, doing my stuff. And at the same time, I am also a disembodied observing presence, usually above and behind by maybe a yard or two, watching myself go through all this stuff. I see a lot of heads nodding. This is one of the ways that we begin to get evidence that consciousness is evolving. And I believe that the natural trope, the natural direction of the evolution of human consciousness, once again, regardless of language, regardless of gender, regardless of economic and political circumstances, regardless of ethnicity, is in the direction of compassion. And that compassion, symbolically as well as literally, has to do with opening our experience, our minds and our hearts, to the reality that other people experience. I don't have to be convinced by it. I can, in fact, even be repulsed by it, but I need to open myself to it and understand it at whatever level of depth I can. I believe that this is one of the reasons, one of the archetypal symbolic reasons for this convention of Asian sacred art, which presents divine and semi-divine beings with multiple heads and multiple arms and legs. Because that's what evolving consciousness looks like. It looks like not only looking through the world through the lenses of my own idiosyncratic belief structures and opinions, but looking at the world through as many belief structures and opinions as I can open my heart to. That is a street-level definition of compassion. If I am not engaged in taking other people's reality seriously, no matter how generous I am not compassionate. There is a sort of sentimental understanding of compassion as sort of a turbocharged, souped-up version of pity. There's pity, and then there's eight-cylinder, supercharged pity, which is compassion, which might actually motivate me to do something instead of just feeling something. But I would like to suggest to you today that from this point of view of the evolution of consciousness and its relationship to the experience of the divine, compassion and pity are opposites. Pity is a separating emotion. If I experience pity, I am primarily aware of the difference between my own circumstance and the circumstance that is evoking pity in me. If I am compassionate, I am aware of the similarities between my experience and the experience of the one who is evoking the compassionate response in me, regardless of how different the surface of appearance of our lives may look. So compassion has to do with connecting, and pity has to do with separating, regardless of what action in the world goes with it. I can be compassionate and broke and not give any money to worthy causes and still be compassionate. And I can be filled with pity and wealthy and give all sorts of money to good causes and not be compassionate. It is ironic, but the evolution of consciousness requires that we become increasingly aware of these ironies. Increasingly aware of these ironies in our own lives and in the lives of other people. Now, one of the things that that means that I'm very interested in is that curiosity becomes a high-level spiritual experience. Those things about which I am genuinely curious invite me to connect with them at greater depth. So the cultivation of curiosity, intellectual curiosity, emotional curiosity, and ultimately spiritual curiosity is one of the most important manifestations of the evolution of consciousness that we are capable of embracing and cultivating. Pay great attention in your own dreams, in the dreams of people you are working with, when the dreamer reports confusion. Because confusion in a dream narrative usually means that the dreamer has fairly clear memories which do not fit the model of waking life. I remember in the dream I was driving in the car and I'm confused about who was driving. I don't remember whether I was behind the wheel or whether my sister was driving. And I report it as confusion. In fact, I am confused because I have two memories. One of me behind the wheel and my sister in the rider's side, and one of me sitting in the rider's side with my sister behind the wheel. And the prejudice of waking life kicks in and go, well, it couldn't be that way. And so I forget that it's a dream, and I call myself confused. In fact, that moment is the beginning of remembering the dream from multiple simultaneous perspectives, of developing more than one head, of developing another set of arms and legs. What I believe the case to be is that we are all dreaming an uncountable number of dreams all the time, awake and asleep. The big deal is not to dream the dreams. The big deal is to remember, because our ability to remember these multiple dreams is the most reliable indication we have of the evolution of our consciousness in the waking world. And that the beginnings of remembering being in more than one place at once, of multiple versions of the dream transpiring simultaneously, we are likely to report in the early stages as confusion, when in fact it is the developing ability to remember more than one thing at once. And the more we are able to do that, I say this out of 40 years of dreamwork experience, the more a dreamer is able to remember multiple different simultaneous experiences in the dream world, the more that person is likely to exhibit evolving compassionate behavior in the waking world. And it is the main message that I want to give you this morning is to take those moments of confusion seriously. Not to slap yourself on the wrist and say, oh, I wasn't paying attention, I should have been able to remember this more clearly, but to recognize that the ability to remember the dream dividing up like a river into a delta with many streams is the beginning of a symbolic reflection of how compassion is entering my life in the waking world. At the psychological level, the experience of the dream dividing into multiple simultaneous versions is very often an indication that the dream is addressing the future. One of the best analogies I can think of is it's like a chess player playing out several different combinations of moves into the future before actually making the move on the board. And that when we are doing that in terms of our lives, we are likely to remember multiple simultaneous versions of the end of a scene. It is, for instance, statistically, in my experience anyway, more likely to happen in the last scene of the dream than any other place. It's as though the dream is reviewing all the material and getting to the point where the decision needs to be made and then showing the consequences of what the various decisions may be like. So I would ask you to honor those ragged edges of memory that seem like confusion. Rather than downplaying them and not putting them in your narrative, I would urge you to put them in your narrative with particular care. And I would urge you to pay particular attention to other dreamers when they report this kind of confusion to you, because my experience is it is likely to be a direct consequence and a celebration of the evolution of awareness, not only of our situations in the waking material world, but of our evolving relationship with the divine. And that's zero. Okay. Okay.